Good evening, everyone, and independent streaming internet radio station from Tulsa, Oklahoma to around the world. I'm your host, Joe Chris. This broadcast is being brought to you live on Wednesday, and it is now 7:01 p.m. Central for us to take back control of our government now before this bureaucrats us, of our property, our freedom, our rights, and our liberty, political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought. What our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution is just about that. I invite you to call 646-652-4620. That's 646-652-4620. Of course, you can send us your email anytime to comments@libertytalkradio.com. I also encourage you to get educated on economic issues. Go to Andy Sutton's website, Sutton, SUTTON-associates.net. In his biweekly newsletter, Andy discusses economic issues and how they affect you. You can also listen to Andy's commentary on ContraryInvestorsCafe.com. Lastly, I would like to remind our listeners to subscribe to our reminder service by visiting our website and clicking on the subscribe icon. Well, good evening, everyone. This evening, we are pleased to have Mr. Andrew Thomas. He's an attorney practicing in Indianapolis, Indiana. He is an attorney specializing in fathers' rights issues. I'll be honest, something I know very, very little about. Denying the rights to equal access to their children. Not only do custody laws favor mothers, apparently, but the IRS, the welfare system, as well as a plethora of unconstitutional legislation, exasperates the issue. This touches on the rights of the father and the children alike, demanding more attention by our legislators. Please listen in. Our call in number is 646-652-4620. Your comments can be also sent to us at comments@libertytalkradio.com, and I believe he is on the air. Mr. Thompson, is that you?
This is me here, Joe. How are you this evening?
Fine. Very, very good. Can you hear me pretty well?
I can hear you just fine. Are you hearing me as well?
Yes, you're coming in loud and clear. And thank you so much for being our guest this evening on Liberty Talk Radio. I'd like to start by saying that I plead ignorance in this area as I've studied liberty and the Constitution, but quite frankly have not applied it very much or very well to children's rights or father's custody's rights. And I guess that's what your specialty is. If you'd like to give our listeners a little bit of background on that, not only about that, but about yourself, and then we'll commence with the program, and maybe if we have any call-ins, we can answer some questions.
Sure, I'd be delighted to, Joe. I'm an attorney in Indiana. I've been practicing for 20 years. I've done a variety of things in my career. I spent a lot of time doing estate planning work and charitable nonprofit work before I was kind of sucked into the vortex of fathers' rights issues through my own life experiences, and first became an advocate and then moved on and took on a specialization in the area of fathers' rights as well. So,
hello, are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yes, I am, Joe. I'm very sorry. Sorry about that. If you go back to 1986, and I started practicing law in 1990, in 1986, there was a major tax reform legislation afoot, which simplified the tax code considerably. And many people didn't know that in order to buy the votes needed in Congress to pass that tax reform, there were some pretty significant trade-offs. One of those was called the Bradley Amendment, named after former Senator Bill Bradley, and who became an avid proponent and leader for tax reform. At the same time, he was pushing the Bradley Amendment, which put into the law what seems to me to be in direct contradiction to constitutional rights of fathers and families, a provision that made it impossible to forgive child support arrearages in any amount at any time. And that's been the law of the land since then. Thereafter, legislation in Congress got even more severe with the passage of things that are so thoughtfully named as the Violence Against Women Act, and later in welfare reform legislation, Title 4D was passed to deal with covering families with in need of temporary assistance, so that the states were then handed an unfunded mandate to go out and collect child support in order to collect revenues to replace other lost revenues from the federal government to provide funding for so-called human and social services.
Okay.
So there's this great trade-off that occurred in the tax system to trade off payments of what were commonly thought of as taxes to payments for child support. And a father that is under an income withholding order for child support will know that he is paying both his taxes, and then he's paying an income withholding order involuntarily as well, not because he doesn't want to support his family or not because he has any choice about how and how much it costs to support his family and his children, but because he is coerced by the government under formulas that basically supplant a segment of income taxation. And of course, the natural incentive that has flowed through our culture is an increase in divorce rates, greater fights about custody and child support, and a much greater alienation of children from their fathers in the past 20 years.
Well, you know, divorce is never comfortable for the children, especially. It's never a comfortable situation. But from a political perspective, it's politically advantageous for a politician to vilify the father and vindicate the mother. Whenever you hear about child support, tagged on to that comment is usually a father who is not paying the child support. Thus, we need some more legislation to get these bums to support children who are now disadvantaged and on welfare simply because the fathers cannot be found. I would say that's the image that is being portrayed of the father in a divorce case. It's the first image you get. In fact, that's the image that I get, and yet I have to fight that. Am I off base, or am I about where everybody else is? And that's one of the problems that we face right now politically and of course, as a result for the father.
Yeah, no, you're right on track, Joe. The extraordinary paradox in our form of democracy is that you can take the political landscape, and it's quite true that by using phrases like deadbeat dad,
right.
You're going to get in those cases where people are directly involved with the issues, you know, the 50% of the population who benefit from that in different types of legislation in favor of it, and the 50% that are hurt by it are either opposed to it or not voting. But the rest of the population, who then clearly is decisive, tends to want to side with the poor, disadvantaged mother and woman and help her out by striking out at the dad. And it appeals to the political conservatives, the political right, the authoritarian right, the non-libertarian right, that likes big government when it's used to impose rules and regulations on somebody other than me, than that person who holds that ideology. And that's what these draconian child support provisions actually do.
Right.
The harsh and cold reality of the situation is that, first of all, the majority of child support does go uncollected, and it likely goes uncollected because it is often uncollectible, because the impositions on child support for people, for generally men who are unemployed, serving in the military, who are disabled, are very high, and the arrearages on child support are by and large with those men, plus one other group of men, and those are those who have been utterly prohibited and cut out of their children's lives, so they don't feel like they have a role as a father at all. They've been cut off in that way, and just give up on the system and live outside of it and don't pay child support.
Yeah, it just would seem that the father in this case would, you know, wouldn't stand a chance in court. You have the mother and the father. You know, the mother again is vindicated. The father is vilified, and then he's trying to at least get equal rights or visiting rights or whatever. And he basically is at a tremendous disadvantage from the very start. And it could be that the mother's at fault. You know, the mother's been doing something wrong. She hasn't been a good mother. She throws him out of the house and says, "Right, now you got to pay child support." It seems to me that you need someone to unravel a very complicated social environment, miniaturized social environment, to find out where the child should go in the first place. But yet the mother is usually the child is usually assigned to the mother. Am I correct?
Well, you are where there. So now with the advent of joint physical custody, and the distinctions have been very sharply drawn between legal custody and physical custody, the majority of cases do end up with parents sharing joint legal custody. That is not a very meaningful benefit in itself, but there are in the state of Indiana about 20% of cases are resolved with joint physical custody. So the parents share, you know, 180 to 185 days a year each parent has the children.
Right.
At least that's what's assigned under the court order. In the other cases, in the other 80%, you know, you start with that 80-20 rule, more than 80% of the time, the mother has primary physical custody. And if you take that, where all of the children in the household are younger than the age of 14, it's well over 90%. You know, preschool children, almost, it's a very rare case. There are certainly cases where fathers have custody, but it's a very tiny percentage.
Okay.
And, you know, to some extent, representing both men and women, I understand why physiologically, biologically, historically, traditionally, and all kinds of other reasons, why there is that little bit of a slant, especially in the early childhood years, and it's not going to go away even if we don't understand it.
Right.
But it becomes much harder to understand the draconian treatment of the father when he is determined to be this lesser status of a citizen called a non-custodial parent.
Right.
And in fact, that status is quite demeaning to women when they're lowered to it as well. It's hurtful to women in those 15% of cases where they become the non-custodial parent too. But it's a very negative connotation in the court system, and it carries with it some very heavy impositions of regulation in the law.
Of the 15% where the child is under the custody of the father, do we have deadbeat moms, or is there such a thing?
Do we have what? I'm sorry.
Deadbeat moms. We have deadbeat dads. We know we have some of those. Do we have deadbeat moms as
well? Deadbeat moms. There was a time when I was enamored of the semantics involved in this, and I've kind of been involved with it for long enough, and personally enough, and professionally enough, that I don't spend too much time on that. I mean, but it's a true statement that you're alluding. There, no one ever refers to a deadbeat mom. It just doesn't happen. What is the cultural effect, outcome, harm of that gender bias, that sex bias? Well, you know, it's great because you can look through, you know, you can watch comics like Family Guy to television programs going back a generation or more, and the stereotype of the father in the home has been rather consistently negative, you know.
Right.
Dad can't keep it together, mom can.
Right.
And the kids are superior, you know, the hierarchy of intelligence and common sense goes, you know, child, mom, then last would be dad. So that connotation is very deep in our culture now, and using a phrase like deadbeat dads is more than unfair. It's really destructive to the family and to the fiber of our culture.
Yeah. Now, isn't it also first of all, let me give you my background. I'm originally from East Harlem, New York. So I am no stranger to high-rise state-subsidized housing. In fact, I was displaced for state-subsidized housing when I was a little kid, and neighborhood has gone to pot. I walked the streets of New York, Bronx, West New York, and you name it. And for some reason, I still feel comfortable in that environment. People think I'm crazy, but I was born there. It's just part of my culture. But one thing that I remember is that when I was young and living there, is that there were many, many women on welfare in the state subsidized housing. Very, very few of them had fathers, and they were rearing multiple children, and the question is some of this deliberate? In other words, the father is really available. They're really, you know, the guy's around and alive and kicking, or they just claim that they're the old man flew the coop, and in order to collect welfare and get more from the state, the more freebies, and while the father really is still available, but they'll never find him. I mean, not physically find the guy, but the mother knows exactly where he is. And he's still supporting the children, if you will.
You know, absolutely. There's a lot of truth to that. What I think, though, I mean, I think you're building the context, the narrative correctly, Joe. And I think you gotta, you know, do it very quickly for people to get a sense of the whole picture, and even while doing it quickly. With enough care and articulation that it can be well understood. So we go through this period in our nation's history from the late 50s, perhaps, at least from the days of the Great Society in the mid-60s, to the mid-80s, early 90s, when single mother welfare was kind of the law of the land. It was where certainly excessive tax money was being redistributed, and the picture that you paint is one that is very accurate.
Yeah.
A truce between President Bill Clinton and Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich to go after these deadbeat dads. You know, never mind the fact that these mothers are reproducing, you know, regularly and cohabitating, and that they're the ones actually getting the checks, and that they're the ones that are being given the incentives to have the children and be paid for it, okay? Forget all that. The target was the male who was staying in the household with them,
right,
living off of the welfare benefits and not going to work. Well, you know, worthy target, but not really even nearly the full target. So if you shift the burden away from the taxpayer in Westchester County, who's footing the bill for all that, to that dad in the housing projects, guess what? There's ends up being a lot less money to go around, number one. That irresponsible father doesn't suddenly become so much more responsible. And mom finds that, you know, her welfare check actually expanded when it became a child support check, because now she's getting some temporary assistance from the government, even while expecting to get a permanent payment of child support from the father going forward, not permanent,
right,
but
right,
at least until the children reach the age of majority.
Right.
So what happens in these situations with the women? I mean, you find that younger women between the ages of 16 and 25 that are pregnant. Now, the majority of children today, okay, so at the time of the welfare reform legislation in the mid-1990s, it was considered a serious problem that we are approaching 30% of children in the United States born out of wedlock. Well, guess what? Now we've got welfare reform legislation, and it's over half. High school educated women, girls who haven't finished high school yet, who see the opportunity to have a child and have a guy support them, even if they choose not to love him, stand by his side, marry him, be part of his life, make him part of the child's life and part of their family, that they're going to get paid for having that child instead of advancing their education and so forth. We got the incentives all mixed up, and we did it because we felt, I think because culturally, we felt like we could use
right,
the government as a heavy cudgel in place of using it as a as an ATM machine
right,
for welfare.
Yeah, well, you know, I think there's an unfair comment that I made, because I really took us off the main track of father's rights, and I went into a welfare issue where the father's rights are not being violated. He's been complicit on a scheme, if you will, to help support his child while he may still be working. And I really went off the Charlie. Let me do this. Allow me, just for quick station identification, we have a couple of callers on the line. Folks, this is Liberty Talk Radio. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano. We're pleased to have Andrew Thompson, attorney, with us from Indianapolis, Indiana. His specialty is father's rights issues, which is a very serious issue today because everything seems to be lopsided. And maintains an environment where the father's rights are unconstitutionally withdrawn. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. We have a caller on the line. Let's get our caller in, see what the caller has to say. Oh, by the way, if you do have any questions, 646-652-4620. That's 646-652-4620. Please call in. Caller, you're on the air.
Well, I'm good. Hello, Joe. This is Joe.
Joe, this must be Joe from Montana.
That's the Joe.
Joe, hi. Okay, how are you, Joe?
How are you, Joe?
Great. Okay.
All right, I just wanted to add a little bit to what Andrew was talking about. Not only is this a father's rights issue, but it's a single man's issue, too, because a lot of single men want to get married someday. And the way that the courts are, they're very lopsided towards the female. And to prove a point, what I've read, in a couple of instances, more than a couple of instances, a woman can go into a welfare office, I forget what the name of it is, but she can practically sit down in front of the guy at the desk, take out a phone book, arbitrarily pick a name out of the book and say, this man is the father of my child. Then they fill out the paperwork, then they go after the guy. Then the guy, even if he's of a different race, he's going to have to prove that he is not the father. And in some states, if my memory is correct, he's not allowed to force the woman to take a DNA test. That's how lopsided the system is.
You know, Joe, I would never have thought of that, but you would think that that does, in fact, happen. Andrew, what's your experience with that, please?
Wow, well, that, I tell you what, I deal with a lot of paternity cases, and very few of them are quite that extreme, but I will tell you that they're very severe on any level. A lot of the guys that I have represented are in the military. Some of the guys were hooked up with a woman for one night, and many, many times they were not involved in fact, the doors were closed to them on being involved while she was pregnant or as soon after the child was born or immediately after the child was born. And, you know, one of the things that I find is a lot of cases where guys know that they are not the biological father, but they were in love and wanted to take care of this woman and her child and, you know, poured their hearts out and went with her to the delivery room and were asked to sign a birth certificate and did. And then the woman takes that to, in Indiana, we have a putative father registry. You essentially have 90 days to refute fatherhood after you're placed on the putative father registry. And if she maintains that relationship with you for those 90 days and you say okay, then you're on the hook for child support for the next 21 years, whether or not you ever see the kid again. And, you know, she may make that very, very, very difficult for you. That's my experience. There's a lot of, you know, DNA testing has become huge. And I think that there will be a lot of reform in the area of paternity in coming years, and it'll probably progress much more rapidly than in other areas of custody and father's rights. But the changes that are likely to come are not going to level the playing field any time soon. It's still tilted very heavily against dads and men in those situations.
Well, Joe, what I suggest you do is get an unlisted number.
You mean like the one I'm using to call you on?
That's right. That's exactly. Stay out of court, you know. When we say father's rights, that's a blanket term. Can we define that any further than we have right now? How would we define the father's rights?
Well, I think that in the area of the law, father's rights basically comes down to rights to parenting, choices of parenting, time with the child, and sharing of financial responsibility with the mother. I mean, really, those two things. Right. Custody, decision-making, and financial responsibilities. And there certainly are...
Those aren't father's rights.
I'm sorry?
Those aren't father's rights. Those are father's responsibilities and burdens. Because the law, as you're talking about now, and the way that I'm familiar with it, is that the father basically doesn't have many rights. If, for example... Just to go off this topic for a little bit, if you don't mind, Joe, but I think this might be a little important, is the fact that what really bugs me is that a father has no right to decide whether or not his so-called baby can be born or not. all of a sudden there's this political ball game where a woman will say, this is my body, and therefore you have no rights, mister, and I will either have the baby, and you will pay for it, or I will not have the baby, and you will pay for the abortion, and you have nothing to say about it. And yet after the birth, the father is now all of a sudden responsible. Because you said sharing custody and father's responsibilities. Father's responsibilities are not rights. Those are imposed duties.
Well, when I say rights, though, if you have financial anything, any financial asset, even if you have a stream of income, you know, the boundaries that protect you are what are someone else's responsibilities. I mean, the rights of the father are, you know, I am restricted from having to bear more than a certain level of burden for the upbringing of the child, and mom has to assume so much of that responsibility too. I think fundamentally we would see a shift in the cultural approach to parenting and custody if we did shift some of the things similar to what you're talking about, Joe, so that if a parent says, I'm not going to allow you to see my children, to the extent that parent is able to enforce that wall or fence to keep the father away from the child, then that parent has to concurrently assume an equal level of financial responsibility, so that if child support at one point is based on income that looks like 70% to dad, 30% to mom, if she's going to take his time away from the children, then suddenly she gets 100% of the decision making and time and you know, this about who gets to spend the time with the children, then she gets 100% of the financial responsibility as well. And if there were changes of that nature incorporated into the law, you know, you would find the notion of parental rights being much more equalized than what's it. Right now it's a spoil system.
No,
if
I
you
agree.
Get custody of the, if you get more overnight with the kids, you get more money, and that's just wrong. It creates a framework for litigation and a battleground, especially in paternity matters.
Is there any state that a man and a woman can sign an agreement that during the course of their being together, that if a child occurs, that he does not have to pay?
Because of the Bradley Amendment and the way it is written and the interpretations of the law since then, until at least the Circuit Court of Appeals rules in opposition, and probably take the United States Supreme Court to overturn those interpretations of law. No, the state is determined to have a fundamental interest in the financial obligations of both parents to provide for the child throughout the period of minority. So you cannot sign away your parental obligations, even if you sign away all of your parental rights under U.S.
So, in other words, we're living in Russia. People can't form their own activities the way they want to. They can't enter into contracts the way that they want to. Strangers can come along, namely the government, and tell us what to do. So what else is new?
That's exactly right. In the area of family law, you hit the nail on the head.
Very good, Joe. I think you summarized that very well for us. Thank you so much. Well, you know, it's very interesting what Joe brings up, and that's the fact that there are rights and responsibilities. Actually, what you get involved with, Andrew, mostly is rights as it results from some sort of economic restitution or whatever. Is that what mostly you get involved in, or do you get involved in other aspects as well?
Well, you know, here's what the landscape looks like. You know, everybody gets caught up in this when it hits home, you know. Dad picks up the phone, calls, emails, I'm in trouble, what do I do? You know, and that's okay. But the problem is, this is not an issue that can be fought case by case, door jam by door jam. This is an issue that is going to take a strong collective effort where there is truly strength in numbers. Really, the fight to win this battle at the ballot box is, in my opinion, not a winning fight, because for every, you know, step that the fathers' rights movement gains in the area of paternity or military service or unemployment, etc., it loses two steps somewhere else. The child support formula increases. Custody guidelines, parenting guidelines are tilted more in favor of mom and move-aways and so forth. So, you know, we're not winning this battle legislatively, and we're probably not going to, in my opinion. The only place that it probably can be won is in the judicial branch of government. And the way I see that coming about is through collective action, through class action litigation, fighting the issues head on where fathers are being discriminated against, where their equal rights have been violated. If the state has a compelling interest in seeing that both parents provide for the children, it also has a compelling interest in seeing that both parents are responsible for providing for the children and not just one. You know, when it's made clear statistically and through experientially that how strongly the playing field is tilted, and that case is properly presented in the federal courts of our land, then we'll have an opportunity to see change. And I have not filed a class action at this point. I'm waiting for the right set of class representatives and the backing to actually support it. At the present time, what I do is handle many, many custody cases for fathers, paternity cases, child support modifications, the whole gamut of issues that come up in an individual father's life.
Let me ask you a question, Andrew. As somebody who's kind of naive in family law, you're saying the battle won't be won in the legislature, it will be won judicially. But if the judges are forced to follow the law, which are created by our senators, then how can a lawsuit win?
Well, the law, because what has to be determined is that the enforcement of the law, the way the laws are being interpreted and enforced, are unconstitutional. They violate a father's rights to equal protection. They clearly and certainly, in my mind, violate both litigants' rights to trial by jury. We're talking about financial issues here. These are not equity issues that were intentionally set outside of the jury system. You know, we're talking about child support, division of property, money issues. It belongs in front of a jury under our Constitution. And because child support didn't exist at the time that the Constitution was framed, the Bill of Rights were adopted, doesn't mean that those rights don't apply to new laws that are established as they come along. But no one has really taken these issues head on, taking it right to the heart of the Constitution where they exist.
Well, yeah. So are you saying that? I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Joe. Go ahead. Go ahead. But please do. Well, I can wait. Well, Joe, let me stop for station identification, which I'm really late on now. It's hauling at me. Folks, this is Liberty Talk Radio. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano. We're pleased to have as our guest this evening Mr. Andrew Thompson. He's an attorney practicing in Indianapolis, Indiana. This evening we're talking about fathers' rights issues. It's a complicated issue. It's quite frankly is one that the more we discuss it, the more questions that I have in my own mind as to really what we mean by that and how much the courts can actually legislate when we're talking about people's behavior, basically, especially when it comes to the rearing of children. If you have any questions at all, please call 646-652-4620. Our lines are now open, 646-652-4620. If I see your number come up and you do want to ask a question, just press number one and bingo, I'll know that you want to interrupt and ask a question and I'll put you on the air. Okay, and send your comments to comments@libertytalkradio.com. Thank you, Joe. Go ahead, please.
Okay. So what I'm getting from you, Andrew, is that, of course, now we're not in front of a jury, and I'd like to have that. Perhaps, I don't know. I was on a jury a few months ago, and you don't want to be a defendant in front of the normal gene pool that's out there. But be that as it may, if we're, I'm serious, nobody spoke English. Almost 8 out of 10 didn't speak English. All immigrants. So, okay. So, getting back to this, if we're in front of the judge now, even a class lawsuit, okay, then how are we going to win? If the judge is supposed to go by the law, the interpretation of the law is supposed to be done by the Supreme Court, unless I'm wrong.
The hierarchy of the law of the land is starts at the lowest level, which is agency regulation, traffic tickets and so forth, interpretations, regulations of the Internal Revenue Code and unemployment. You know, those kind of things are the lowest level of the of the law. The middle tier of the law is legislation and case law. And depending on which state, which court you're in, you know, legislation generally has a higher level of authority than case law interpretation, but it takes cases to interpret legislation. Okay, that's the middle tier on the hierarchy of the laws of our land. The highest level is the Constitution of the United States. And the Bill of Rights, the last time I looked, and I have a copy hanging on my wall, clearly provided the right to jury trial as interpreted under English common law, which allowed any issues, any financial issues between litigants to be allowed to be determined by a jury. Most states, I think 26, I think 24 don't, but most states do allow for jury trials in divorce cases to determine divisions of assets. That's unusual given that, you know, all the other issues go before judges. So the Constitution is applied in places as it should be. In other places, it's ignored. My point is that we need to bring to the attention of the courts the necessity of recognizing the highest law of the land, which is the Constitution of the United States, which guarantees the right of trial by jury. It guarantees equal protection for all citizens, and it has been determined to apply on the basis of sex, as it should. And there are a host of other provisions within the Constitution, that, including the 10th Amendment, which has been overridden by things like the Bradley Amendment and Title 4D, which impose upon the states things that should not be constitutional. And there are cases, some of which you may well be aware, that are, you know, being litigated around the country on other issues right now on these very constitutional rights.
Well, you know, where I'm trying to wrap my head around this whole thing is that how do you determine this? Because if the father is alienated from the family, and he's out of the house, the mother is the one that's the primary caretaker, if you will. There are decisions being made every single day with that child, and it could be hundreds of decisions made every single day with that child. If you ever raise kids, you realize you're making a decision every 2 minutes. But the father is, in fact, divorced, if you will, from that whole process. So although he may be paying his the alimony of X number of dollars per month, he's not part of the process, and the only time he's part of the process is when the child is given to him for his 2 weeks. And so in effect, you know, he has little input for, let's say, for 2 weeks while the mother has the child, but then he has total input, he hopes, you know, when he has the child. And if that's considered equal in the eyes of the law, then you look at from the child's point of view, it's got to be awfully confusing, because the mother may be telling him, you know, red and the father blue, or whatever it is, you know, the situation may be. And how do we wrap our hands around that, and how do we call that equal rights of the child, for example, in that case? Or is that a stupid question?
You know, one of the things that I've argued is that look, you know, when I argue for dads, I say this all the time. You know, I love the Constitution, I love the best interest of the child standard.
Right.
And I love it for my client, who happens to be a man and a father. And I love it, for this reason. The best interest of the child, Your Honor, cannot be put into practice by any people in this courtroom, including me and the man in the black, man or woman in the black robe at the bench, by any other people than the man and the woman who shared their seed to conceive this child.
Right.
Okay? So that child's rights, that child's interests are only attained in our system of justice, okay, as we've accepted that it's appropriate too, because they're minors, because they don't have full capacity for themselves. Their rights can only be attained, they can only be advocated, they can only be received through either of their parents. If you alienate one, you strip the kid of half of their rights, is what you do in effect, and there are system of laws. Yeah. And for that reason, if you're interested in the best interest of the child, then dad ought by right to have an equal say in the upbringing of the child. Now, in practice, that never happened. It never happened. If it does, if there's a caller out there, if there's a listener, I'd love to know about your experience where you could say, yeah, we really split our decisions right in half. We really equally divide them. It really doesn't. The custodial parent, the parent who has the children with them, most of the time is making by far, not just the majority of the decisions, but nearly all of the decisions that affect the child's interest. And the ways of going about balancing that are very complex, and you've hit on a really serious issue, and one that is, is probably more intractable than the issues of child support, shared parenting, paternity, and so forth.
Yeah. What is the number one issue that you face, or specifically in your practice, in order to equalize the rights of both parents?
The number one issue that I face in my practice in order to proceed toward the equalization of the rights of both parents, you might find surprising. It is the intervention of psychologists, paraprofessionals, and therapists whose opinions become tantamount to the courts and to their final decisions, and outweigh the parents' say or real life experiences.
Okay, I'm not that smart. You're going to have to give me an example.
Okay, sure.
You can give me a Dick and Jane example. That's fine.
It's very common. If there's a custody dispute and either party asks for a custody evaluation, even if they don't, for the court to order the intervention of a so-called independent custody evaluator or a guardian ad litem. And that party will then become responsible for deciding what is in the best interest of the children, right, how much time with each parent, what share of decision-making goes with each parent.
Yeah.
That person is basically appointed as a demigod to that family. And so, for example, in a case I had in South Bend, a paternity case I had not too long ago, where father's family lived in New York, mother's family lived in Indiana. The father was needed to be in New York for his extended family. The mom stayed in Indiana with the child, even with the invitation to live in New York with the father. And the father wanted to exercise time with the child, to meet halfway, to spend some of his time with the child in New York, to visit when he could in Indiana, and so on and so forth. The mom basically said no, and the court said, okay, we're going to appoint a third-party expert. That person was a guardian ad litem. They hired a physician. The physician did a number of tests and experiences and said, you know what, this child needs to be with mom all the time. This child can't be out of the care of the mother at any point in time. She had a home court advantage because everybody in the case was in the county where she lived, and she had the weight of being the mom and the, right. and the youth of the child in her favor. And the court basically, you know, ruled straight down the line in her favor. And I'd say 9 times out of 10, when there's a guardian ad litem or a custody evaluator, mom wins.
Yeah, well, you know, I didn't think about that when someone does move out of town because of work and whatever, then that creates a whole new venue of problems. We have another call on the line. Joe, if you'd like to continue holding your more than welcome sure. to stay on the line, and let us take no call problem. Number. Let's see. This is from area code 918-796. Caller, you're on the air. Your question, please.
Hello. Thank you for a very interesting program. I wanted to ask more of a theoretical question, I guess. Constitutional protections have typically or originally been more favorable to males than females. Females had to fight for the right to own property, to have credit, the right to vote. If you can think that the Constitution does favor the mother's side in this area, when was the point historically when this concept or this attitude developed, and how was it incorporated into the law? And I'll take my answer off the phone. Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. That is such an interesting question because the caller was correct. You typically have someone who is... women's been fighting for their rights. That's why they have the League of Women Voters and all this other stuff. And yet, when it comes to this arena, it seems that it favors the mother rather than the father.
So, here's my take on that. It's actually, in my own opinion, really paternalistic attitudes that have created the environment, the political environment, that has brought the state of the law that we have about. My examples of that would be, if you look at the people have pushed the legislation that has prevailed in this area, you would find that, for example, Vice President Biden is a hero of the feminist movement for being a champion of the Women Act. You would also find that it was Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich who got together to pass welfare reform. It was Bill Bradley who passed the Bradley Amendment. Why, it's a very odd thing that these paternalistic attitudes, if you look at kind of a truer libertarian, heartfelt sense of feminism, of equal rights for women, of equal rights, equal empowerment for women, okay? It's attained through laws, and not necessarily laws, but opportunities in the workplace, opportunities in the marketplace, in the free market. You know, it's quite interesting in California. You've got Meg Whitman and Carly Fiorina on the Republican ticket, both former CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, you know, running for national office, or not national office, but statewide office. You know, they're not women who are clamoring for protection in the area of family rights. It's my opinion that this is a paternalistic means of creating a battle between the sexes that has great political advantage to get the support of women, to give them a sense of empowerment in ways that really only create conflict with men and don't give them any true financial
and that's why it's not power. That's why it's not paternalistic.
Yeah.
Just because men in suits have been passing the law doesn't mean it's paternalistic.
Right.
They've been influenced by women. Because to be paternalistic means you're doing something in the favor of men. This clearly has not been in the favor of men.
Right.
And you're talking about Clinton and Gingrich. I mean, and the other guy that you mentioned, these people, they're not even for America.
Okay. Joe, I'm sorry. I apologize, Joe. I will have to cut everyone off because we are about 2 minutes before the hour, and we are going to lose our phone line if we don't shut down the station. Joe, I'd like to thank you very, very much for calling in and joining in this conversation. You've added a tremendous amount. I mean, a lot more insightful than I would have made it. So I appreciate your calling in, and please continue listening to Liberty Talk Radio. I hope I hear from you again. Good night.
Good night. Right. Take care.
And let's see. So we have here, we have about a minute or two. Why don't I just give it to you to wrap up, okay?
Well, thank you, Joe. Thank you so much for having me on the program tonight. It's a very interesting topic and very not only timely but appropriate, I think, for your program. I've been part of the libertarian movement, Libertarian Party here in Indiana for some time, and I find that fathers' issues, fathers' rights issues, are not well understood or talked about within the circles of people that are really champions of liberty yet, and I hope that will change in the near future. And I'm an advocate for that. It's my life's work, and I want to encourage anyone who's listening to, number one, to visit my website at reformfamilylawnow.org, at familylawandfathers.com. That's a blog that I have, familylawandfathers.com. And also feel free to contact me toll-free at 877-365-1776 if you're interested in more information or becoming a part of this movement. Thank you again so much for having me on the program with you tonight, Joe. I hope I'll listen in often and hope to be with you on your program again.
I hope you'll accept our invitation to return. And if you'll send me just a mailing address in your T-shirt size, I'd love to send you an official Liberty Talk Radio T-shirt.
Can't wait to get it.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much and good night.
Good night.
Wow, that was interesting. It's a little different. This is the end of today's broadcast. We'd like to thank Grant Jacobs Audiology for the financial support, and I'd like to thank you for listening in. You can further the cause of liberty by recommending this program to your friends and let us hear from you. Our email address is comments@libertytalkradio.com. Remember, you're either allowing your liberties to be taken away or you're striving to protect them. Unfortunately, there is no middle ground. Ron Paul has a sign on his desk that says, "Don't steal." The government hates competition. With that, until next time, I'm Joe Cristiano. This is Liberty Talk Radio. Stay well. Stay tuned.